Good morning. It's 6 minutes after 9 o'clock. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. New unrest in Tibet has focused attention on this small country nestled in the Himalayas, known as the Roof of the World and the Land of Snows. It has also heightened world concern for the way that the Chinese government treats dissent in Tibet. These concerns take on greater than normal importance because the Summer Olympic Games are set to take place in Beijing later this year. This hour, we're going to talk with two different guests about Tibet. First, we're going to learn something about the history and culture of the country, and then after 9:30, we'll welcome in another guest who will help us fathom the geopolitical implications of the relationship between the Chinese Communist government and Tibet. My first guest is Geshe Thupten Dorje, an ordained Tibetan Buddhist monk. Geshe Dorje is based in the Tibetan Cultural Institute of Arkansas at the University of Arkansas and joins us by phone. Good morning, Geshe, and welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
You were born in Tibet at about the time of the Chinese Communist takeover, and I understand you and your parents escaped along with thousands of others. How did you end up in the United States?
I was escaped from Tibet to Bhutan. I stayed 9 years in Bhutan. After that, I went to India, South India, to study Tibetan Buddhist philosophy over 24 to 5 years. After that, in 94, I came to United States with the Mr. Guru Art of Tibet, organized by Devon Losling Institute in Atlanta. And then, after that, 96 to 7, I studied English, and then later I'm interested in teaching universities and colleges. And then, you know, since that, I teach many universities like South Alabama and right now here, University of Arkansas and Fayetteville in Arkansas.
Now, your title, Geshe, has a special meaning. And talk about that, and how did you obtain that level of learning?
Well, Geshe is literally means, you know, a spiritual master, which is probably around three times equivalent to American PhD degree. And in order to attain the highest level Geshe called Geshe Haramba, takes around 24 to 5 years study, intensive learning, 18 to 17 hours a day, study, you know, debating, you know, intensive memorizations, and a lot of those, you know, effort to require to reach that level, yeah.
So the when people think of Tibet these days, when they think of it, mostly when we hear about Tibet, it's because of protests going on or some sort of unrest. But a lot of people perhaps think about mountains or snow or Buddhism, not necessarily in that order. But Buddhism has become, I think, probably the sort of the face of Tibet to the rest of the world. When did Buddhism come to Tibet, and how did that affect Tibet's culture going forward from then?
It's a really good point. Around 8th century, late 7th century to early 8th century, and Tibetan kings are very much interested in Buddhism because before that, Tibetans are very aggressive. We over-occupied half of China to around, you know, many part of India. And by that time, Tibetan people are more get tired with the war, you know, fighting, killing each other. So we're interested in Tibetan Buddhist principle of the nonviolence. So Tibetan masters, you know, went to India for study, you know, Sanskrit and Hindi, and brought with some Buddhist, you know, Tibetan Indian master to Tibet. And Tibetan people, basically, early time, only two times. Tibetan people translated entire textbook of the Buddha Dharma to Tibet. And by that time, Tibet had their own religion called Pen religion, was very much like a shamanistic or animistic religion, which is Tibetan people are not like, you know, come bring Buddhism to Tibet, not because, you know, they don't like their own religion, they don't like, you know, to leaders of the Bon religion, doesn't mean that. It means bring here, make Buddhism comes to Tibet, the Bon religions become much richer, and also to, Tibetan love has become more compassionate, patience, tolerance, and, you know, that, in fact, tired Tibetan people's life, Not only about that, since 1959, around 100,000 Tibetan people escaped from Tibet to India with wonderful leader of the His Holiness Dalai Lama. We managed to preserve all Thai Tibetan culture, philosophy, religion to India within last 50 years with difficult circumstances. Not only but we preserved, we contribute in a rest of a nation like Western nations who are interested in to learn Tibetan culture and philosophy, religion. We openly share with those people.
You mentioned the Dalai Lama. Talk about the origins of the Dalai Lama. That's to me a fascinating story.
Origin of the Dalai Lama. First reincarnation of Dalai Lama was around started from 13th century. Great Tibetan masters called Lama Tsongkhapa. His disciples called Gyendun Trub. He was the first reincarnation of the His Holiness Dalai Lama. Although Tibetan Buddhism believe Dalai Lama have been there Tibet more than before that, but officially recognizing since from 13th century to until now, continually recognizing as reincarnated of the Dalai Lama. Dalai Lama reincarnation is really, you can see deeper level to how they're reborn, where they're reborn. Why is a reincarnation? He born as by choice, not like me or ordinary people can born without by choice. Around I would say Genghis Khan, Kublai Khan's power to whole world in Tibet. Dalai Lama was born in one of Dalai Lama's reincarnated in Mongolia. By this 13th Dalai Lama, and he is reincarnated border of the Tibet and China as armed region. And there are many significance of the how they reincarnated, where they reincarnated, and you can see many significance like this, signs of that ordinary human being, like me or someone else.
Well, how do you know? I'm trying to probably going to ask this question very badly. I'll ask forgiveness in advance. How do you know who the next Dalai Lama will be, or where they will be reincarnated? How do you know where to look, and what child is going to be the Dalai Lama?
Really good point. Let me say, one of the Dalai Lama was extremely. He wrote a lot of poems, songs, and he's very famous for those things. When before he's dying, he wrote a poem, say, I won't go more than Litang. After Dalai Lama's dead, everybody confused, what we can do now, where we're going to search Dalai Lama's reincarnation. Now, finally, they look into his poem, what he wrote to it. He was told he won't go no farther than Litang. So they're looking for reincarnated in his reincarnation down to Litang. They found his reincarnation down to Litang, not only for he wrote it to it, and he have an external sign, internal signs, and they are not ordinary people like me, and they can recognize as the past relatives, and they can recognize atoms that belongs to past Dalai Lamas.
I'm going to give the phone numbers and invite some people to join us with their questions about the culture and history of this fascinating portion of the world. Here are your phone numbers, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. And if you're in Milwaukee, we'd like you to use our local number. That is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And we do have lines available for you right now. Very little, I think, is known by the average person about Tibet, and probably half of what we do know is wrong. It as happens when a country like the United States, we tend to look inward rather than outward much of the time. Tell us something about Tibet that and its people that is not commonly known, or that would probably surprise us.
generally, in Tibetan history, to go back to about 2,500 to around 3,000, go back to stories like this. And the Tibetan people are, and generally, before, like I mentioned just briefly from the beginning, and before Buddhism arrived to Tibet, Tibet was really known as very aggressive in human being living in a group of the world. And since Buddhism arrived to Tibet, blessed of the historical Dalai Lama and Buddha of compassion, Tibetan people are adopt to, their life is living with harmony, peace, and environmental and loving compassion, treated everybody more than Shiva himself. Can you imagine those older generations, like old grandpapa, mama, they don't have any understanding of Buddhist philosophy. But as soon as they get up morning early, they pray for all sentient beings. Before go to bed, they pray for all sentient beings. For survival, they have to kill one yak for a whole entire family for a year. But they don't mean it. They hunt, hurting those living beings with by torturing and making suffering. They do best they can to less suffering, to and pass away, to die. After the death, even they collect that yak's bone or the horn, the curved mantra to pray, remember those people, those sentient beings, give their life for survival for us. Not only for that, Tibetan people deeply consider every single human being can contribute our happiness, and our happiness is 100% depends on surrounding human beings. So Tibetan, generally, 95% Tibetan people you see, those are very open-minded, smile, and no fear, and just respect other people's view, other people's religion. Don't have any hatred toward any human being, any religion. For myself, I grew up within Tibetan community. I never known to Buddhism, never preach. And if you are not Buddhist, you go to hell. Those things are not impossible. A Tibetan culture system, they respect every human being, including small mosquitoes and bugs. And that's how Tibetan culture is, non-violence. So therefore, we try to reach our aims or goals for freedom nation, or you can say highest level of the autonomic region of Tibet out from Chinese government or communist dictations. Those are our aims, goal to reach. And even now, you can see those things that are now going on in Tibet,
Why then? I'm trying to figure this out, and perhaps I'm just naive. Why is it seems to me that the Chinese government is afraid of Tibet? Why would they be afraid of? Why would they? What about Tibet bothers them that they feel that they need to crack down?
They're not fear of Tibet. They're not fear of Tibetan people. They are fear of the truth. That's their fear. The fear of truth will come up sometime. What they're doing in Tibet. Deep down, Chinese people believe Tibet is part of China. Why are they destroying their own culture, own religion, own philosophy, and own people? None makes sense. They're destroying every single thing belongs to Tibetan people, with environment to the Tibetan people. I mean, that's not make sense for myself. Deep down, they know that Tibet is not belongs to them. So therefore, they don't want Tibetan culture there, and they want to disappear identity of Tibetan people forever. That's what their aims to go. Not only for Tibet, they like to overcome power of the whole world. That's what we need concern, a world concern. For that, it's not about Tibetan people are hatred, angry toward the Chinese people. We don't make enemies of the Chinese people. We're not fighting with the Chinese people. We're fighting with Chinese policy. And that is that's not good to have, for not only for the sake of Tibetan people, also Chinese people, or globally. Tibet is the root of the world. If we contaminated the root of the world, what would happen in the rest of the world, in Asia, and globally? We'll be miserable, and sometimes we'll be, unable to control a lot of disease, those come through from these nations and Asian nations. I mean, those, for me, are deeply concerned. Tibetan cause is not about just for Tibetan people. It's about globally. It's about the whole nations. It's about all people. And that's, for me, very important. Also, we're talking about peace and harmony. We need to support someone stands on their path to the peace. That's the most important, what I consider, you know. Peace be, and not generated by hatred, angry, fighting each other. Peace to be generated out from love and compassion. Peace is the manifestation of the love and compassion. Concern, we need respect to other people. Thank you. Yeah.
We need to take a break, and when we come back, we've got some people who are on the phone who want to talk, who want to ask some questions about Buddhism and about Tibet, and so we want to get to that.
Thank you, sir.
And we'll be back in just a moment with more of our program. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn today. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 23 minutes after 9 o'clock, you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what's coming up later on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At 9 o'clock tonight, we'll have special election coverage. Wisconsin goes to the polls today, bad weather or not. And we're voting on, after a very contentious campaign, for a justice on the Supreme Court. And there's also a referendum on the ballot and a number of local initiatives and judgeships and so forth to be voted for. And at 9 o'clock tonight, the Michael Leland and the Wisconsin Public Radio News Department will have a summary of election results. So that's coming up tonight at 9 here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about Tibet and the people of Tibet and about Buddhism, which is the religion of the Tibetan people. And to help us through this discussion, we have joining us by phone from the University of Arkansas and the Tibetan Cultural Institute there is Geshe Thupten Dorje, an ordained Tibetan Buddhist monk. And you can join us by phone as well. Here are the numbers to call, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. In Milwaukee, please use 227-2050. And we do, as I said, have some callers who want to chime in. And we'll go first to Bill from Sun Prairie. Bill, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I want to say that I really think it's great that Wisconsin Public Radio has brought attention to the Tibetan plight and have this guest on your show. I'm a student of Buddhism, and I could ask 100 questions, but I'll narrow it down to one. I understand from studying the Dharma and the Panchasila, the precepts, that one of the first principles are do no harm or do not kill sentient beings. And I think also of the fact that if in the last resort, killing is ever allowed, that's the question. And I'm thinking in particular of one of the Jataka tales of Buddha in his past life. There's a story of Buddha being on a raft and rafting some merchants across a river. And with clairvoyance, he saw that one of these passengers was going to kill others, and he, Buddha, killed the passenger to prevent further loss of life. And using that tale, my basic question is it ever allowed in Buddhism to actually kill if it meant to defend yourself or to prevent further loss of life, or is that a categorical command that you never kill?
Bell, you have a really wonderful questions, and I will make a little bit go in beyond detail about what Buddhism is. And Buddha taught general philosophy called Vinaya textbook. During the Vinaya textbook, Buddha taught everything and not kill, not stealing, not sexual misconduct, those 10 non-virtues of karma. Those follows of the Buddhism and those follows of the Vinaya textbook, monks and nuns, those people took those vows to literally taking those things. Then second sector is Buddhism, and then comes to not only for Vinaya textbook, fundamental based on Vinaya textbook, and the Kulamayana tradition. The Mayan tradition and Binaya, a follow of the Theravada traditions, are basically two ideas. And Binaya textbook, follow of the Binaya textbook, the Theravada traditions are very much follow. They says, because Buddha says so. And Mayan follower says, not because Buddha says so, why Buddha says so. That's the most important part. And the consequences of the action. So a lot of people consider nonviolence is that, you know, do nothing, sit there and no actions. And according to Mayan tradition, Buddhism, and Mayan, and nonviolence is not just but sit there, do nothing. And nonviolence manifestation of love and compassion. You see, they are Mayan followers, members of the Tibetan people, such like they are, you know, sacrificing their life to, and they put life to danger to, they know they're going to be killed. But in general, society is not good. But they put their life for benefit of other living beings without any selfish reason. Those things can be sometimes. It's in if action is manifested by love and compassion, not by hatred, angry toward any living being, and that can ensure himself put into that position, but in not by any, you know, not for want someone miserable life, someone to be, you know, wish to someone's death. That kind of thing is not impossible. You have a really good point. Like you're talking about Bodhisattva who sacrifice his, and you know, life or this and that thing, and he killed this and that thing, is it's not that ordinary people can do, you know, and ordinary people unable to control his or her anger and hatred. I would say, you know, that would be not a good idea.
Bill, thanks for that call. I want to go next to a call from Sean in West Bend. Sean, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I had a question for the if he knows anything about the status of the Panchen Lama.
Mm-hmm. What about Panchen Lama?
I just wanted to know if you knew anything about his condition.
No, and we didn't hear Panchen Lama at all. We believe Panchen Lama is still alive. We believe that. In even one thing is very interesting, Tibetan caste things you will see. And my opinion, okay, my own opinion and concepts, understanding of reincarnations, like, you know, Panchen Lama. If China is going to kill Panchen Lama, they are afraid he will be reincarnated without Chinese permission. That would be their concern for that. But however, we didn't hear anything. We wish Panchen Lama is alive and he will do as the past Panchen Lama in the long run and benefit other many sentient beings. We wish his life, he was healthy, and he's living peaceful in harmony with his family and his teachers. Everybody's disappeared, and with that sad things, you know, very difficult.
I believe the Chinese government says that he's being held in secret for his own good. He and his family are being held someplace, and that they're living fine, but they don't want to tell where this person is because they're afraid for his life. That's the official
version. Yeah, it's the why is afraid for his life. In past Panchen Lama, none of the Tibetan people tried to kill Panchen Lama. And why they need to put him to secret places, nobody know. And he's not a treasure. He's not like a statue stupa to set up with the other statue stupa. He's a human being. He will come up sometime, talk about his own views of the what is right, what is wrong. And that's what Tibetan people are doing right now. You know, the Thai Tibetan people come up, his or her, you know, right to purchase to, you know, and I'm a freedom nation, and that's. I hope Panchen Lama will come up sometime later. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you, Geshe, for being with us. We have another guest we want to bring in, and we're going to take the discussion in another direction here in just a few moments. I feel like we could spend a number of hours and still not probe even a portion of what we should talk about Tibet and its people. And note to Rhonda Fanning, the producer, we might want to rebook this guest. But thank you for spending this time with us this morning and for teaching us about what you believe.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
The Genji Tupten Dorje is an ordained Tibetan Buddhist monk, and he is based at the Tibetan Cultural Institute of Arkansas at the University of Arkansas. We appreciate his time this morning. We'll stay on the line because we've got more to come about Tibet in this hour. For the next part of our program, please join me in welcoming Joseph Fewsmith, Director of the East Asian Studies Program and Professor of International Relations and Political Science at Boston University. Good morning, Professor, and welcome to the program. Whoops, there we go. Good morning, Professor.
Did it work? Thank you very much for having me, John.
It worked this time.
Okay, good.
The Beijing government has imposed a massive military crackdown on Tibet, and what has been the general reaction of the rest of the world to this?
Well, maybe we should start with a little bit of a correction there. I believe that there have been some PLA troops that have been moved in to Tibet, but most of the crackdown was carried out by People's Armed Police Force and local police rather than as a military action. And so there's been, I think, a fair amount of misunderstanding about exactly what's been going on in Tibet and in Tibetan areas throughout China. What's been the world's reaction? Obviously, the world's reaction has been, I think, to urge restraint on both sides, particularly the Chinese side, and hope that things calm down fairly quickly, because this is it does disrupt both the world's hopes as well as China's hopes to have a peaceful summer and a successful Olympics.
Yeah, this is the Olympics is scheduled for Beijing later this year, and it would seem this is a very awkward position for the Chinese government to find itself in. It's certainly not something they wanted to have happen, or you would think they wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I can't, you know, we can't know what people are thinking, but it's would be illogical for them to say, "We're having the Olympics. How about if we have a dust up with the people in Tibet before we have people come in?" The protests, in fact, seem to have almost been timed to create this situation, and perhaps call attention to the plight of Tibet. There's been some talk about boycotts. The number of countries have already suggested that they're not going to send their teams. Other countries, we heard the British Prime Minister last week say, well, we're still coming. How likely is it, do you think, that or how widespread will boycotts by other countries be by the time the Olympics actually takes place?
Well, we'll have to see how this situation develops, of course. But if it's if it comes down reasonably soon, and that there are not reports of widespread bloodshed or so on, I think you're going to see most people showing up. What we've seen so far is really suggestions of boycotting the opening ceremonies. I've not really heard of anybody suggesting that they actually boycott the Olympics per se. So far, at least, most countries seem to be holding off, saying that they still do intend to send their athletes. And, you know, I think that that's probably the way it will develop.
800-486-8655 is the toll-free number to join our discussion about Tibet and about the crackdown that's going on there in face of protests by Tibetans, and not just in Tibet, but in other areas of China where there is a Tibetan population. 800-486-8655, 227-2050, please, if you are calling us from Milwaukee, 227-2050. We're talking about Tibet this hour. We spent about 25 minutes or a little more talking about Tibetan culture. I want to bring Chinese culture into this discussion for just a moment, because my understanding, China refers to itself as the Middle Kingdom, and by that they mean, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, that they're the center of the world, and everybody else needs to look to China. How does this worldview then affect how the Chinese respond, or how they would see other countries suggesting that they might boycott a portion of the Olympics?
Well, actually, the term Middle Kingdom, I think, comes from the fact that a lot of the early Chinese dynasties were based in the central plain of China, and it was really distinguishing themselves from the Western tribes that were coming in, and indeed took over China and merged with Chinese culture. The traditional Chinese term for China was actually all under heaven, which probably sounds worse to you than even the Middle Kingdom does. But it was a culturalist view that they represented the most advanced culture in the world. And certainly for their part of the world, that was probably true for much of Chinese history.
We have some callers who would like to join us, and Mark from Viroqua has been holding patiently. We'll go to him first. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for taking my call. Just a little background. I'm a family practice doc in southwest Wisconsin, and I do have a brother-in-law who is Tibetan, and I really like the Buddhist philosophy. My comment is that I believe that there's the distinct possibility that some of the Tibetans are becoming violent in their protests. There is definitely the possibility people, when they're frustrated, often act out of their frustration and not necessarily what their deepest held convictions are. However, the accusations that the Chinese government are making against the Dalai Lama, that he is fomenting violence, absolutely flies in the face of his extremely long and stellar track record of working towards peace and compassion in the world. And the Chinese do have a very strong history of suppression and oppression. And also, I recently saw a photograph circulated on the web that showed there were Tibetan monks that refused to take part in filming whatever it wasn't made clear from the photograph what the film was, but the Tibetan monks refused to participate, and the picture showed Chinese troops donning Buddhist costumes. So there is the possibility that this could be a ruse, which would not be inconsistent with previous Chinese actions. So the situation is complex. You know, Tibet has gone back and forth between being autonomous and being part of China, as virtually every country in the world has done. The Chinese are predominantly, I believe, interested in Tibet for its natural resources, and many groups have been very concerned about how they have been aggressively utilizing these resources and not putting that much back into the community. And so I'm sorry I'm taking so long, but the bottom line is I would have far more suspicion about the Chinese government's actions and motivations than the Dalai Lamas and the Tibetans themselves. And I'll take my comments off the line. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that call, Mark, and thanks for being patient and holding. I was reading that the Chinese government is suggesting that the Dalai Lama is behind these protests and behind the violence, and that seems absurd on its face, but it's not a surprising accusation to see leveled in the press.
Well, that's true. They have been blaming the Dalai Lama and the so-called Dalai Lama clique, and I really, it seems to just come from sort of the worst instincts of the propaganda machine in Beijing. Perhaps it suggests the level of distrust there. I think that their action or their response this way was just simply incorrect. They should have very early on said the Dalai Lama has called for peace. He's also never argued for an independent Tibet. And it would behoove Tibetans to listen to the Dalai Lama in that sense. But they just don't seem to be able to reach out to the Dalai Lama. And I think that that's unfortunate. I think he's part of the solution, not part of the problem, from their own point of view.
You made a point that I want to go back and pick up on, because from as I was reading in preparation for the program, one of the things I noticed was that it doesn't seem that that Tibetans are asking for independence. What they want is autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference?
Well, autonomy is within the People's Republic of China, within the borders. So autonomy would be presumably include such things as control over your own educational system, cultural areas. There may be, it'd be interesting what it does exactly include, if it would ever worked out. Would it include any controls over, say, internal migration? Because one of the Tibetan complaints lately has been Han Chinese migration into Lhasa and other areas. So it's not quite clear what that would mean. Would it mean that Tibetans would rule Tibet completely autonomously, a nation within a nation? That would probably be a non-starter from Beijing's point of view. So you're right, the term autonomy is a more complex term than it seems on the face of it.
What will happen after the Olympics? Do you think China will really clamp down on Tibet once the crowds are gone?
There are two possibilities. One is that they'll probably clamp down, which I suspect is probably what will happen. The other possibility is that they're going to have to, it would be nice if they would really do a rethink of their own policy. I think that the Chinese generally think that they've been treating Tibet well. They've been pouring in a lot of investment, providing schools, providing some economic development, and they think that Tibetans should be happy. They're not. So it would seem that somebody should say, what's not working, and start reviewing policy. I'm not very optimistic that that's going to happen.
Let's take another call. This time we'll go to Kasser in West Bend. Good morning.
Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I can.
All right. I believe I am a born Muslim, but if I ever had a choice, I would have preferred to be a Buddhist. The cause of Tibet and Palestine and Kashmir are very close to my heart. And I believe that that is just how I just wanted to express myself. But then at the same time, economically, if you look at it, we have immense buying power. And we import, billions and billions of dollars worth of merchandise, goods from China. Is it possible that we can twist the Chinese arm and, let's say, impose a 5% import duty on anything that comes from China and take 2% of that and reinvest it in Tibet? Because I think what happens is you cannot win autonomy in nowadays by protesting or fighting wars. I think we learned that in Kashmir, we learned that in Palestine, and we learned that in Iraq. In today's world, we cannot win a war by dropping bombs. We have to win wars through progress in economy, and if we promote that in certain parts of Tibet, and we say, okay, anything that is imported from Tibet, anything that is produced in a certain region of Tibet, it will have no import duty, but anything that comes from the rest of China will have a 5% or 3% duty. I think that would, if the Chinese treasury is hurting, they are going to react to that, because to them, earning almighty dollar is more important than Dalai Lama or Tibet. It's insignificant. And I think if China was a small country, we would have been able to achieve what we wanted to achieve in terms of helping the people of Tibet. But China is becoming the next superpower, and they don't want us to tell them how to treat their people. However, I think the fact that we are such a huge economic giant, we can use that indirectly to achieve our objectives. And I will take your answer off the air.
Thanks for that call.
Well, that's a very interesting proposal, something I hadn't thought of. There are lots of calls in Congress to put duties on Chinese goods for other reasons, usually to address the trade deficit issue. Haven't thought of it in terms of Tibet policy. Obviously, anything that enhances the Tibetan development economically and culturally, I think, would be a good thing. Doing it in terms of tariffs is technically difficult, because it's going to be very difficult to distinguish which goods are made by Tibetans and which may are made by Han Chinese, whether it's in Tibet or in other parts of China. Just the technical problems of sorting that out strike me as very difficult. But there may be some things that we could do to stimulate some trade and help develop the Tibetan economy.
Of course, that economic pressure is a two-way street. The Chinese are holding most of our paper.
Well, they're holding an increasing amount of our paper these days. That's correct. Seems to me in the past we used to borrow from ourselves to fight wars. Now we're borrowing from China and other countries to fight wars. Very strange, ironic situation.
You mentioned the Han Chinese. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, the most Chinese are of the Han nationality. That's everything from Guangdong through the northeast and so forth. China officially has 55 so-called national minorities, which include, by their definition, the Tibetans, the Uyghurs, the Kazakhs, the Manchus, Mongols, and other national minorities in smaller numbers throughout the nation. The Han Chinese make up about 92% of the population of China.
We're going to take a break, and we'll come back in just a moment with more calls and more discussion about the situation in Tibet and how that may or may not affect the upcoming Olympic Games this summer, scheduled for Beijing. Here are your phone numbers, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, please call us at 227-2050, 227-2050. I'm John Munson. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 10 minutes before 10 o'clock. Here's a program note. Tonight from 9 until 10 on the Ideas Network, tune in for an election night special. News director Michael Leland will host the coverage, talking with Wisconsin Public Radio reporters about the race for state Supreme Court between Justice Lewis Butler and Judge Michael Gableman, as well as the referendum on the so-called Frankenstein veto. Join us tonight at 9. For election coverage here on the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about Tibet and how that situation there and the protests and so forth might spill over into the Olympic Games. My guest in this portion of the program is Joseph Fewsmith, Director of East Asian Studies Program and Professor of International Relations and Political Science at Boston University. Well, Professor, before we go back to the phones, I want to ask a question about a news story that I read. China seems to be pressing India to support its Tibetan position. Would that be in India's best interest? Where do India's interests lie here in relationship to Tibet?
That's a difficult question. India has always been very sympathetic to Tibet. They share a religious affinity. Tibetan Buddhism and Indian Buddhism are different, but they are related, have historical origins there. And, of course, India has been the host to the Dalai Lama and the exiled Tibetan community that has gathered in Dharamsala since 1959. So that goes back a long way. On the other hand, India has been improving its relationship with China and vice versa in recent years, and they do want to have a good diplomatic relationship with China. Generally speaking, the Indian government has been willing to play host to the Tibetan community, at least on the implicit condition that the Tibetan community not engage in provocative actions. And so this does catch the Indian government in a bit of a difficult position. They want to support the Tibetans, but they also would like the situation to calm down so they don't disrupt their diplomatic and increasingly an economic relationship with China.
We'll go back to the phones and take a call next from Pat in Washington Island. Pat, good morning.
Good morning. I was wondering if we could have a little more historical perspective. Like, before 1959, did Tibet have its own complete separate government? And did the rest of the world then view it as a separate country? And therefore, I wonder how it changed that we all agreed. If it's true that China took over Tibet, then why do we all just refer to it now as part of China, since that was it seemed from what I read that was a really aggressive thing. I just don't understand how this all comes down now that we all accept it this way, or maybe was Tibet always a part of China, but we just thought it was a separate country? Something like that.
That's a good question. There are, of course, arguments that go back and forth about whether China was, or Tibet was part of China from time immemorial. Obviously, it was not. There's been a long and difficult relationship between Tibet and China. And China, you know, you start talking about sort of pre-modern times, the concept of China as a country, as a nation state is ambiguous at best. But the Qing dynasty, the last dynasty of China from 1644 to 1911, did have control over Tibet. It was part of the empire. But, you know, that sort of control is more of a what we would call suzerainty rather than direct control. Beijing was not sending in officials that imposed direct control over Tibet. It just had exercised a general overview of Tibet, but it was part of the Qing Empire. When the Qing Empire fell, it is interesting that there was no argument either in China or really in the world community that the map of China really did not change. This could have been different. You could have had the Han Chinese believing that in order to be a nation, they needed to get rid of the national minority areas, but they didn't. And that has been part of the story of modern Chinese nationalism that has seen all the borders of the old Qing Empire as part of that. And it is interesting that the rest of the world has accepted that definition, and that's not just a modern thing. It goes back to the British had extensive interests in, of course, in India and hoped in some ways to wean Tibet away from China, but they never pushed that issue of Tibetan independence in the early part of the 20th century, and it was never agreed upon by the Chinese. And the interesting thing is after the 1949, the world accepted that. Although the CIA was deeply involved in with Tibetan community at that time, the United States at no time ever recognized an independent Tibet. And, you know, this is one of the things which I think it's difficult these days, because if you try to call for Tibetan independence, which goes beyond what the Dalai Lama wants, I think that you're only going to set the Tibetan community up for great tragedy. And so, you know, this is a difficult and tragic situation, and I think both Tibetans and Chinese need to work on trying to resolve their problems.
Let's take a quick call from Christopher in Green Bay. Christopher, please be brief. We're almost out of time.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to, first of all, I'm really glad that we're having this, that this topic is on the show today. It's something that I think more Americans need to be aware of the situation. But I agree with the two callers ago when he was talking about putting a duty on exports. I think boycotting the opening ceremonies or boycotting the Olympics doesn't really send the same kind of message as it does is if you start, when you start messing with the money, that's when people listen. That's when governments listen. So if we start adding 3%, 5% duties to all of their exports, I think that would be a much stronger message than just boycotting the Olympics.
Okay, I'd like to give our guest a chance to respond. Thanks for the call, Christopher.
Thank you.
And we got about a minute.
Obviously, international economics is complicated, but as you mentioned, they're buying a lot of our T-bills these days, and if they buy fewer of our T-bills, our interest rates go up and our housing crisis becomes more serious. That's the short answer.
It really is a two-edged sword.
The world is economically interdependent. If you wanted to boycott toys, you don't put anything under your Christmas tree at Christmas because 95% of the toys in the world are made in China.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have little kids at home anymore, so I don't have to worry about that. So I guess I'm a one-man boycott all by myself.
Well, maybe you'll have grandkids, nieces, nephews, whatever it is. It's difficult. You can have these righteous calls, but then you go out and you shop at Walmart because you want to save money. Well, you can't have it both ways.
Yeah, there is the righteous indignation, and then there's the real world, and we have to live in the latter, and the first one is the province of call-in talk show hosts, I think. I thank you so much for spending this time with us and helping us to understand. I realize this topic is way more complicated than 25 minutes can give it, but I appreciate you coming in and clearing up a few things for us anyway.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and hope it clarified some things.
Joseph Hugh Smith is Director of East Asian Studies at Boston University. He's Professor of International Relations and Political Science there as well. And last I checked, they had a heck of a hockey team. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. John Treader handled on-air production. I thank both of them very much. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.